Welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another show here talking about disaster response, disaster preparedness, and what the heck goes on with those teams that come in and help us out from a federal or state or local level to manage a major event in our areas and how we can be better prepared to do that. So we're going to talk about that. And before we get into that, I do want to talk a little bit about our panel here today. And that starts off with the amazing and incredible ever-present co-host of the Disaster Podcast, Sam Bradley.
Oh, amazing and incredible. I love you, Jamie. And let's just hope that we respond to all of your incidents. We're not going to have any here in California, despite what the weather says. But we would sure love to come out and see all the rest of you when you have your tornadoes and earthquakes and hurricanes and such. Just saying.
And your DMAT's on call right now. Is that correct?
It is. The first week of hurricane season. Yep.
So it looks like it's going to be quiet. So this week and a quiet season in general, it's what I've heard. So we'll hope for that. We also are joined on the call by two of our great friends from the Paragon Medical Education Group. We have Dr. Joe Holly with us. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Good to be back.
And really excited that we have Jim Logan joining us. Jim hasn't been on the show for a while. He's been out traveling and doing a lot of fantastic education and training with the Paragon team out and around. But Jim, it's great to have you back in town and joining us on the show.
That's great to have my feet back on the ground. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, well, we'd love to have you back. We missed some of your unique insights, and we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say about things tonight.
We missed you, Jim.
Well, I missed you guys. It's great to be back.
So, before we get into talking about our main topic tonight, and that topic is going to be talking about the medical care for the disaster response team themselves, how we manage their health during a disaster response. We wanted to just talk a little bit about some current events, and Sam and I already kind of touched on it. Hurricane season starts this week, and I found an interesting article over at CNN. There was a study presented this week at the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that has made the assumption or made the presumption based on their research that feminine-named hurricanes versus masculine-named hurricanes cause significantly more deaths, apparently because they lead to lower perceived risk and less preparedness. Now, this is from a team of researchers. Not everybody's buying into their hypothesis, but interesting how we examine and re-examine all of the things that happen with hurricanes and named storms.
Oh, boys, will you never learn? Being the female representative of this podcast, we just make you think we're warm and fuzzy. But can you say Katrina? I would think after that, people would have changed their thinking. What do you think, Joe?
I totally agree, Sam, on more levels than I probably should.
You know, I'm just interested to find out who funded that, and I want their phone number. That's great.
Well, it's interesting. Researchers for the National Center of Atmospheric Research say the pattern is a statistical fluke, and they're not buying it. But it's just it's interesting what kind of research pops up out there and how we look at the different things that occur to us from the results of natural disasters. There's all kinds of ways we personify them and give them names, but they all have the potential to be deadly and affect us, and we should treat them all as individuals. I can't believe I'm saying this, but treat them all as individuals unto themselves, because each storm is very different. And, Katrina was devastating in its own way. And then you look at Sandy, which was devastating in a completely different part of the country and had different effects. So I think that, you just have to treat all of these events, whether it's a tornado or an earthquake, an impending storm, treat them with respect so that you know what to expect from them.
Yeah, and they're saying something I didn't hear before was part of what's going on in the Atlantic is a wind shear factor, which I guess diffuses the formation of a hurricane, where out here we don't have that, so therefore there's higher potential of them developing. I learned something new today.
So, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Jim, I often think there's too much credence given to the category level, although that's important for a storm, you know, as far as severity goes, and we need those things, sort of like with the tornadoes, you know, the torcon levels and things like that. The point of the matter is that a tornado is a tornado. A hurricane's a hurricane. No matter how strong they are, they're deadly. And so I think sometimes we get wrapped up into the security is, oh, it's only a category one, but it's only a category two. When you're the person that it's staring down at, category one is just as deadly as a four can be.
Depends how it hits you. And if they tell you to evacuate, there's probably a good reason.
Well, and I've heard the guys on the Weather Channel say this, I don't know how many times, they too take issue with the categorization of hurricanes, because they say a slow-moving category one is more deadly than a fast-moving category four. Sure. Because it dumps so much rain and the wind damage is compounded, and so a big slow-moving low-level tropical storm or low-level hurricane can be equally devastating or more devastating to a region because of the fact that it's, you know, it's dynamics. So I think that, you know, there's something to be said for that, Jim.
Yeah, and I remember back in 1985, and it was one of the very first deployments I went on. I was working for Red Cross at the time, and that was bizarre because it wasn't a huge storm other than it came in, it dumped a load of rain, it filled up the levees and then went out, gained strength, and came back in again, because these things are so predictable, just like tornadoes. It can hit one house and miss the next and hit the next. So you just never really know what they're going to do.
So I guess it just, you know, just as we move throughout the year, we'll be noting different things that occur and different seasonal changes, so that whatever... I always say this on my other shows, you know, when you're moving into different seasons, it's the time to, this time of year is the time to bone up on your water rescue knowledge and work out how you'd manage a near drowning patient or something similar or overdoses. We see a lot of overdoses this time of year as the high school kids graduate and start acting stupid because they got nothing else to do. So, you know, whatever time of year it is, you're going to have certain events that are more likely to occur, and that includes natural disasters. And so be prepared and know what to expect. And sometimes that can be half the battle. So just one of the reasons we bring up current events and talk about them here on the show.
Any suggestions for drought season, Jamie?
Water bottle.
A large one, yes. Jim, Joe, was that you out there?
That was Jim. I think that was one of the reasons for me kind of bringing that category topic up is, you know, we just got the reports in that, you know, today being the start of the season, and then but it's not supposed to be a very active season. However, just like the category level, don't let that put you in a false sense of security, is that we're not going to have, that we can't have a bad hurricane, because it could, you know, it's just predictions all it is.
Well, and they still predict 1 to 2 major hurricanes, and it's, you know, 1 to 2 major hurricanes, if it's out in the middle of the Atlantic, not a big deal. If it's a major hurricane forming in the Gulf that's going to sweep in and hit the Gulf Coast and then move up the eastern seaboard, well, that's a whole different ball game. And so you can't be complacent. Preparedness falls to each and every individual and household.
Sure.
And I think that's important to keep in mind.
I live by it.
Yeah.
Whatever can happen, will happen.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I think here on the Gulf Coast, we're just we're due. You know, we've had a couple of good seasons as far as not having, you know, an active you know, scenarios play out. So I think we're due.
Well, let's hope not. Let's hope it doesn't happen. But I know what you're saying. And, you know, statistically, you're going to have a certain number of them in a given time frame, and it is it is time for that to happen again, unfortunately. So, but I just wanted to point that out, and that's why I brought up the hurricane seasons and the article I found. And I'll have a link to that article if you want to read this study for yourself. You can take a look at it.
Yeah, as Jimmy Buffett said, there's no reason to hurricane season.
Yep. So I thought I'd jump in with our main topic now. And one of the things that we talk a lot about is how responders take care of the people that they encounter. And we've talked about crush injuries, and we've talked about all kinds of ways that we deal with different people with disabilities, with lots of different problems and situations. But something else that goes along with that is managing the health of the responders themselves. When you go into these situations and you're kind of on your own, and Joe kind of brought it up when we were brainstorming ideas for the shows in coming weeks. And Joe, I thought it was a good time for us to talk about that and talk about the health of the responders with you and Sam and Jim.
Well, I think you're right, Jamie. You know, there's a lot of different aspects to that, from sort of doing the initial screening of the team before you go out the door after the call has come in for deployment, and then sort of how you monitor and take care of the team while you're on a deployment, and then, of course, the follow-up once you're back to make certain that everybody's okay and that there's not any long-term consequences of anything you may have been exposed to. So there's an awful lot of different aspects to that, an awful lot of different disciplines that come into play, from occupational medicine to emergency medicine to psychiatry and nutrition and you name it. There's all sorts of different aspects to it.
So, Joe, you mentioned it starts off with checking over the team before you deploy, when you get the initial call that it's time to get out and start heading down the road. Are there things that you flag right away and say, hey, you know what, this is going to be the time you go out? Or is it something that you look for? Or are people supposed to self-report?
Well, it's a little bit of all those things. You know, certainly the approach has to do with making certain that the individual is healthy enough at the time to be able to make the deployment. And that can be everything from, you know, is their blood pressure under control to do they have enough medications to last them for a 2-week deployment? You know, it may be that simple, but I think you also have to take the approach of someone who may have a short-term illness that is going to be placed in very close confines to all of their teammates may well have a dramatic impact on the ability of the team to work 2 or 3 days later when that GI virus, for example, has spread throughout the team and has caused illness in a multiple number of persons on that team. So, you know, it's not only about screening from the standpoint of making certain that the individual is healthy, but screening to look for hazards to the team itself, because those impacts can be quite profound when you get out in the field.
Jim, what do you see as the role of the leadership in the team to monitoring for those kind of things? Is this is this something that, you know, you really need to educate the team about the fact that they are part of a team and that they need to let everybody know when these types of things are going on? Even if they want to go on the deployment, it may not be the right time for them.
Well, from a leadership role, I think that our team does a very good job of. We've fostered that culture of, you know, you've got to have your meds. You've got to make sure that, you know, you haven't had a fever in the last couple of days. Those kind of, because unfortunately we've lived it. Our deployment to Salt Lake City, if I could talk about that for a second, we were almost shut down because of a GI virus that got out of hand. And the origin of the virus. But that person knew that they had that when they went off it. So we really from that instance, you know, it's lesson learned, right? we've learned from that, and we've kind of, from a management or leadership position, we don't tolerate. There's pretty much zero tolerance when we go out on something like that, because it is a team mission, and one person can cause that team to fail.
Sam, what about for the DMAT teams? You know, you guys are coming in. You're a larger group, and you've got more people to deal with. But the same type of small illness, which didn't even occur to me before we started talking about it on this podcast, but good grief, a GI illness in a small group in a confined space like that could just wipe out a team's ability to do what they need to do.
Yes, and we've had situations with those GI viruses as well, and especially when you're sleeping at night in a tent with 20 of your new best friends, in pretty close quarters, it can be pretty devastating. So that calls into play. Like Jim was saying, don't be a hero and think you're going to go out on a deployment when you're sick, because exactly that can happen. Second of all, use your basic safety precautions. Wash your hands. I mean, you're not only in contact with team members who could be sick, but you have all of these sick folks, like going into an ER, that are coming into the tent, that if you don't use the proper precautions, there's every likelihood that even if one of us picks something up from a patient that comes in, we're in the same boat.
So we've got the team prepared. Everybody's well for the deployment. Everybody's in peak condition, ready to go. They've got their meds. They're ready to manage their own issues and situations, and ready to deploy for 2 weeks. But they're going for 2 weeks into a situation where they're going to be crawling around doing different things, dealing with all kinds of unusual situations, unusual environmental things going on. And without the normal comforts of home, this is where, Joe, the team starts to get those little bumps and bruises and things that start to take their toll.
Well, no doubt about it, Jamie. And you touched on a couple of really important issues there. One is that you are being exposed to environmental conditions that are different from where you've been. And, you know, and in many cases, you know, I sort of think back on things like hurricane deployments where, you know, the storm has caused significant damage and may well have stirred up environmental issues that, you know, generally wouldn't be a big problem. But suddenly there are, you know, spores and fungi and all kinds of stuff in the air that have been stirred up by the storm that the rescue responders are inhaling now. And, you know, if they're not used to that exposure, may well develop an allergic type response to that, where they get coughs and runny noses and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, one of the challenges for these deployments is often trying to figure out, is this more of an allergic kind of response that the team is having, or are we being exposed to some other organism that's causing a bacterial or viral infection? And it becomes really challenging. Obviously, you don't want the entire team to be placed on antibiotics if they don't need it. But at the same time, it can be really challenging to sort of sort out the subtleties of those different disease processes and figure out what's really going on there.
And there are so many little regional viruses and things out there that, you know, are local to even an area of different areas of the United States, that if you're not used to it and you're not from that region, you may not have developed some of the immunity that the local residents have developed.
I think you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, it's being exposed to an organism or even just an allergen that you've not been exposed to before, or that in general has been, in very low concentrations in that area, because most of that weed or whatever it is, you know, died out or under a rock someplace. And now the hurricane has stirred all that stuff up and exposed all that stuff to the atmosphere so that it's all floating around in the air where it didn't used to be. So it can make for some really interesting exposures for sure.
Jim, what are some of the things that, the most common medical issues that are dealt with by the team early in a deployment?
We were kidding before we went on air. I was talking about feet You know, feet are not designed to be in boots or shoes for 24 hours a day. It's just not possible. And sometimes we're in those environments. So we get a lot of skin breakdown, being very serious here when we go on these deployments. Saw a lot of it during the hurricane deployments, and even at the Pentagon, because you had in both cases you had a lot of water issue with that. So a lot of just what you guys were talking about, just a lot of allergy type stuff, and a lot of issue with skin breakdown due to prolonged exposure to water.
And so really, I mean, people need to be aware of good personal hygiene and management with regard to that, dry socks and all of that. It really is about educating the team.
Well, and that's totally correct. And when we, and I'm sure DMAT's the same way, and Sam could probably talk to that, but, we have a pack list as far as what we're supposed to bring with us. How many pairs of underwear, how many pairs of socks, how many T-shirts, how many changes of clothing. And that's because and you need that. That's a minimum of what you need to bring because, you're changing out clothes, at each at least one time through each work cycle, or need to be. And it's very important that everything stay dry as much as possible and have the proper footwear. And you mentioned the other thing, which was, we are creatures of comfort. And so you can always tell a rookie that goes out on these deployments, and those are the guys and gals that don't bring their flip-flops when they don't need to have the boots on, that don't bring those simple things from home, like a pair of tennis shoes, a pair of jeans, those kind of things. So those are very important to get that, to let yourself enjoy that downtime with those creature comforts that we need to have, and then keep yourself, fit as far as hygiene goes, as you said.
Hydration's a big one too. And
oh, yeah.
When we get working, I know these guys have to agree with me because I'm a worst offender because you get busy working and you don't think about drinking water. And the next thing you know, we actually have what we call a P chart, and I'm sure you've seen it, Jamie, where we'd put these up in the bathrooms and you would look at the concentration of your pee, which tells you if you have this, you need to drink this much water to get back up to where you should be. Joe, I think you had a thought.
Well, I agree. And I think it's another aspect, and that has to do with sort of being an environmental, medical provider in many cases. So it's making sure that the team is aware of the hazards that may be around them, whether that's, toxins in the environment of some sort, or maybe it's just the, good-willed folks in the neighborhood that you're working close to that want to help out and, bring out a bunch of sandwiches and leave them sitting on the side of the road for you. They're certainly well-meaning, but, after those have been sitting out there for a while, they're really not so good. So, yeah, you have to really keep the team on its toes as far as paying attention to those kind of temptations that can actually ultimately be really negative for you. Obviously, you don't want to, hurt the feelings of the folks that are trying to help you, but at the same time, sometimes you have to say no, and just because you don't know how long that hot dog has been there and where it's been and how it got prepared, and that it may well end up making you sick.
Yeah, and a lot of the times we'll go ahead and just be gracious and take the item, whatever it is, and then dispose of it on down the road a little bit, just so they want to give back to what we're doing and show the appreciation. So it's hard to turn that stuff away, but sometimes you have to. So we've kind of developed that Southern hospitality, if you will, that courtesy, and just say, thank you, and just kind of march on down the road and get rid of it somewhere else.
That's a good way to do it. Joe, how much surveillance do you do, knowing that, you know, you're going into an area that's been hit by a hurricane, you kind of know some of the potentials for the area. How much surveillance, or do you have folks that do that surveillance in terms of what's likely to be stirred up, what kind of problems are surfacing with the public? How do you guys handle that?
Well, there's a couple of different aspects to that. You know, we do a sort of medical intelligence function, which has to do with, you know, what are the endemic disease processes? What are the endemic animals, toxic animals? You know, are there certain spiders here? Are there certain kinds of snakes here? Is it malaria season? You know, all those kind of things come into play because obviously you have to be prepared to respond to them and or protect yourself from them. We also do that medical intelligence piece of figuring out what are the medical capabilities of the impacted area so that if and when one of the guys on our team has a problem or experiences an illness or an injury, we already know that Hospital X has the right capability to take care of our guys, and we've already figured out this is how we're going to evacuate them, how we're going to get them there, this is how long it's going to take, here's the phone number, et cetera. So we spend a lot of time in that preparation mode of gathering as much information as we can so that we know what our resources are in the event that we need to access them, not only for the human members of the team, but also for the canines as well. So we'll know what veterinary resources are in the area and how to reach out to them and what they can do. And are they really as capable as they say they are? And, you know, a lot of that work is going on while we're en route to that area.
And I would assume that your cache, including the food that you eat, and you're certainly the water, because you don't want to drink local water in a situation like that, it's all, you're self-sufficient within your team in terms of, what, 72 hours? I know that's about what we suggest for a DMAT.
You're right, Sam. We're actually up to 96 hours of self-sufficiency now, just based on historical trends.
Jim, you had something to say, didn't you?
That was it. We've extended that because of what we've been through with deployments like Katrina, that we, you know, we've had to be more self-sufficient. But what I was going to say to Dr. Holly's comment was, you know, information is knowledge, but only if it's shared. So the medical team of the task force, urban search and rescue, you know, we gather that medical intelligence, but we don't keep it to ourselves. We share that with safety briefings, which are given 2 to 3 times a day, just to let the guys and gals know this is serious business. These are the wildlife that's indigenous to this area. These are the outbreaks that have been seen in the last 2 weeks before we got here. These are things you can expect if you don't keep your hands out of your mouth like we told you to, and wash your hands and those kind of things, you know. So we don't keep that to our – we keep a lot of the stuff to ourselves, like, you know, locations of the veterinary office and things like that. But as far as things that need to be shared to the team as far as health issues, that is we openly share that, and it's openly accepted. So I think that's a very important thing for team dynamics to – so medical is not just something that's over here in case you need it. It's something that's ongoing all the time.
Yeah, and do you guys have like a team safety person? I know on fire deployments, on wildland deployments, we have someone that needs to be in that role. And basically there's a briefing every morning on what happened the day before and what they're looking forward to that day and some of the problems they may have run into with other people getting infected by something. And I know you have some nasty snakes down there in the south. Is that the kind of thing you do?
Yeah, there's a safety officer that's attached to the team that's assigned for that responsibility, and that person is kind of brought into the loop of, you know, the medical stuff as well as, you know, what other environmental, you know, issues are out there as far as structural collapses and, you know, those kind of things. But yeah, that person is brought into that safety briefing, so we kind of work in tandem with that, whoever that person having that responsibility.
And Joe, is there other agencies, say, within the area that you might tap into to find out? I mean, the CDC, of course, isn't everywhere, but, you know, thinking of them as an example, to find out what kind of infectious disease issues they may be, especially as we move through the latter stages of an incident?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's going to be the local, regional, and state health departments. Certainly the CDC is very helpful with that kind of stuff. Oftentimes, as the deployment matures, there's increasing information that could flow out from the Emergency Operations Center or, you know, a joint command center that begins to have that kind of information on site. Oftentimes, the other thing that may be going on is that the team itself is being sort of constantly monitored by the medical team during the deployment. And you know, we're looking for trends and issues and patterns in that complaint that you know, cue us that something may be going on. We've been exposed to something in particular, or we're beginning to see the onset of a viral illness or an allergic response or whatever. But, you know, we even use that log to, as mundane as it seems sometimes, where we are collecting information about somebody asking for a couple of Motrin because their back hurts or my feet hurt or I got a headache or I'm not sleeping well or whatever. You know, you can watch the numbers of folks who have complaints and notice at some point in deployment that those complaints sort of increase exponentially or logarithmically even. And begin to get an idea that this team is really nearing its exhaustion point. You know, folks are so tired now that they're making mistakes and they're not being safe and they're hurting themselves, et cetera. And that may be a signal that some sort of intervention may be necessary, whether that's just simply we need a good night's sleep. We need a day off the pile. We need something to intervene here to keep people from hurting themselves and reaching such a point of exhaustion that they become physically ill.
And that kind of goes back to what we were saying at the top of the podcast is even as individuals, we have to look out for each other. And if you see something you know is just not right for a certain person, then we need to communicate. Jim was saying, that communicating those issues is really important because we can't act on it if we don't know what's going on.
And it seems like, you know, part of this is that, you know, we need to be talking to each other. We need to be educated. And I like the concept of the past experience has taught you all so much, Joe and Jim, that you've learned as each deployment has progressed and you've come back from each deployment, you've taken lessons learned and applied them to what you're going to do the next time you go out. And that's so important. It's one of the things that I think makes what you guys do with Paragon so valuable because you take those lessons that you've learned for many years of response and deployment and work them into unique training opportunities and educational opportunities so that people get a real experience of a taste of what it's like to be at a major event and be part of a major response. And so they're not caught unawares and they're better prepared and know some of the things to keep an eye out for beforehand.
Yeah, I would agree. Just going back to what Jim was saying about the packing a bag. I mean, as we do, we have a very specific list of things that are minimum requirements of what we need to have in very specific quantities. But when you have some experience out there, you kind of learn, these are the things I want to bring. These are the things I don't want to bring. I'm laughing when Jim is talking about, you know, stuff that he knows what I'm going to say, too. It's like the rookie will bring the color TV, the iPad, the iPhone. Yeah. I mean, all of these gadgets that they're probably going to end up getting ruined or lost. You know, bring a paper back, you know, so if you lose the darn thing, it's not going to be terrible. But when you have some downtime, you actually have something to do. So these are just the kind of little things we learn, packing bag in a bag. We could do a whole podcast on how to pack.
I mean, definitely. So it gets to a point that even your significant other, right, knows if when you get the call to go to the, you know, local Walgreens or Rite Aid or whatever, or, you know, grocery and pick up certain items from beef jerky to M&Ms to you know, some kind of Tom Clancy novel and pack in your bag because you're trying to scramble and get everything else together. So it's about those lessons learned. And that's what we like to share with those folks that come out for the education that we offer, is to give, you know, we can't truly recreate the situation for you. And we hope to God you never have to be put in that situation. But going through that type of training, that the experience that we offer is unique enough to where we hope that you can take some of what we've experienced and bring back to you and put into our education, being interactive like that way, those lessons learned, that if you do happen to be put in those situations, you can, you know, it'll be a little rote memory for you other than, you know, looking at it two-dimensional in a textbook.
And I think that's one of the things, you know, that people need to understand, that, you know, we've all been through those classes where it's death by PowerPoint, and or we've taken online video classes where, you know, we're trying to multitask and do multiple things while the video is playing in the background, and we're just not getting the educational experience that we need to get. People really need to take an opportunity if they see that you guys are at an event like, EMS Today or EMS World Expo or something like that, or you have one of your local events that you're doing in a given region where you're coming into an area and doing education. They really need to stop what they're doing and see if they can get into that training, because you really bring that unique sense of experience to the event, and you leave people with some very valuable tools that I don't think they get anywhere else. So I just want to thank you. It's one of the reasons I'm so excited to have you guys as part of our team here and sponsoring this podcast and making it available for all the people that are listening out there.
I think it's part of our calling. It's part of our giving back to this industry. It's for me, it's the least I can do is do, succession planning, if you will, and trying to, teach those who haven't been fortunate or unfortunate enough, however you want to look at it, to be, thrust into those situations. However, so somewhere in the back of my mind, I think that we all in this industry kind of sickly wish for things like this to happen so you have that experience. It's not just Dr. Holly and I. It's we have a team of folks that help bring these experiences from coast to coast doing these classes, and we're very selective in our instructors and our facilitators. And one of the requirements that we have is that these folks that work with us alongside with us have to have walked the walk, not just talk the talk, but walk the walk and been involved in an active shooter, in a hostile MCI, in a man-made or natural disaster. They have, it's not just teaching, something of written word. It's something you've lived.
Makes sense. And in all of that, I can feel good that through this podcast and through what you're doing at Paragon, that we can't give people the experience ahead of time, but at least we can prepare them the best we can. So when they do, I go out there, they know what they're going to get into, and they're going to come back healthy.
Definitely. Joe, where can folks find out more if they want to look up and see what Paragon's up to and maybe try to find out if there's going to be some education in their area, or maybe even bring you into their area to do some specific education?
Well, we're certainly happy to do that. We could pretty well go anywhere, anytime, and perform that education on site for honestly just about any venue. You can find us at paragonmedicalgroup.com on the web, as well as on Facebook. And our Twitter feed is paragonmededu.
And Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, at the usual social media places, Facebook, Sam Bradley, SamBradley11 at Twitter, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website, where I hope all of you will go and make your comments on the podcast and let us know what you'd like to see in the future. And where do we find you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under Podmedic in most places, and of course, all of my shows, including the Disaster Podcast, available. You can check them out over at mediccast.com, and Disaster Podcast and many other shows just like it. Almost 50 shows now are over at the ProMed Network at promednetwork.com. So if you're interested in healthcare programming, from psychology to nursing to emergency response, you can find all of that over at the ProMed Network and check it out over there. This has been a great episode, guys. And I just want to thank you for sharing this expertise with the audience. And I don't know if they realize how lucky we are to have a team of people with the experience, the vast amount of experience that they have. I'm the newbie here. I'm not a major disaster responder. I'm a paramedic and work in the local response area and haven't, knock on wood, haven't had to deal with a major response incident in my community. But, it's something that I'm thankful to have access to these resources. And I hope that the rest of you out there will share this podcast with people you know and let them know where they can find it and how they can listen to it themselves and check out all of the past episodes. That's it for me. We're going to close out the show as we always do. Sam, you want to take us on out?
Well, I have to tell you, Jamie, if you ever do have the big incident back there in Maryland, me and Jim and Joe will be there to help you out. So, and just remember that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.